Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Today's episode is about sexual assault and may be distressing to some listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised. Margaret Atwood once said, "Men are afraid women will laugh at them. Women are afraid that men will kill them." It is true. We are also terrified of being raped. Our culture has conditioned us to expect sexual violence to come from a stranger. But in fact, less than 20% of rapes are committed by strangers. Our worst nightmare is often used as a plot device in movies and television. It's a home invasion, where the perpetrator rapes and murders the woman. Or a woman is seen walking down a dark alley or parking garage, already nervous, when she is attacked by a masked man. It's not that these types of violent sexual assaults don't happen. It's that you're more likely to be assaulted by someone you know, someone you trust. The nonprofit organization RAIN, the largest anti-sexual assault organization in the United States, estimates that 39% of rapes are committed by an acquaintance, and 33% are committed by a spouse or current partner. And there is another category I didn't realize was high enough to garner a percentage. According to RAIN, 2.5% of rapes are committed by a non-spouse relative. That number is much higher when we're talking about juveniles, where 34% of assailants are family members. In today's episode, a 19-year-old woman named Wanda McCoy opened her door to a man she knew, a man she trusted. After he brutalized her and took her life, he also took her identity when he manipulated the media, claiming he was an innocent man. Wanda McCoy was forgotten. She took a back seat in her own story, while her killer dominated the front page of Time magazine and was interviewed on national television. I'll get to his name in this story, but for now, her name is Wanda Faye McCoy. Welcome to episode 121, The Rape and Murder of Wanda McCoy. The city of Grundy, Virginia, is in the heart of Appalachia, wedged between the state lines of Kentucky and West Virginia. It was originally developed along the Liviza Fork River, a source for transportation and power until the town suffered from 9 major floods. Starting in 1929, with the last major flood in 1977, Grundy located many businesses to higher ground to prevent future damage. There used to be a mountain opposite the historic town, but it was blasted to provide the 13 acres of level plateau where much of the town was relocated and redeveloped. It was a federal project that started in 2001 and included building a flood wall, construction of new bridges, and the relocation of several roadways. The original town was founded in 1858, along with the formation of Buchanan County, and it was named for Felix Grundy, a United States Attorney General and Senator from Tennessee. Grundy was incorporated in 1876. The courthouse still standing today dates from 1905 and is listed on the National Register of Historic Places and is protected by the new flood wall. There are differing opinions on Native American tribes in the Grundy-Buchanan County area, but most historians believe that they were driven out by the Cherokee in the 1500s. During the Civil War, Grundy became a stopover for Union troops on the way to the Battle of Saltville. Though the Union troops were defeated in this battle, they returned to the area and successfully destroyed the salt works located there. Grundy was traditionally a coal mining town since the late 19th century, but a decline in mining hurt the economy and population. Grundy is the seat of the larger Buchanan County. Though originally named for the 15th American president, James Buchanan, I am in fact pronouncing the county like the locals do. So please spare me your pronunciation emails. I have a neighborhood in my hometown pronounced Buchanan instead of Buchanan in the same way, so it isn't even an unusual regional pronunciation. Today, Buchanan boasts both a school for law and pharmacy, efforts made to draw in new residents and fuel the economy. Grundy was chosen as the site in an effort to revitalize the town after the flood of 1977 caused such an economic decline. The Appalachian School of Law was opened in 1997, and the Appalachian College of Pharmacy in 2005. But today's case happened in 1981, so I'll tell you more about the area from that time. Author John C. Tucker was really helpful for this background. Up until the 1930s, Grundy was inhabited by stray farmers attempting to develop the mountain soil. But by the 70s, United Coal moved into the area and began purchasing cheap land around the town and in Buchanan County. The only real business in the area is from coal mining. And in Buchanan County, there are three types of the industry: strip, drift, and deep shaft mining. The deep shaft mines in the county are considered to be some of the most dangerous in the country. The deadly, explosive, and outrageous amounts of methane gas released from the mines mean that extra wind and circulation is needed to create a manageable and safe working condition for the miners that spend hours of their days breathing in dark, thick air. It's dangerous, backbreaking work. But despite these conditions, the biggest employer in the town had remained the mines since the 1970s. As described by Tucker, quote, "For a miner who avoids being crippled, burned, or buried alive, the usual question is which will give out first, his lungs, his back, or his knees." The town was comprised of a handful of businesses, the mines, and the county courthouse, which features a bronze statue of a miner and symbolizes the work of most men within the city limits. Slate Creek reaches beyond the courthouse and empties into the larger Lavazza Fork, a major source of flooding for the town and the eventual reason why the city was relocated. Grundy, Virginia is the epitome of small-town America. There were only around 1,700 citizens in the 80s and about 1,000 today. It really is the kind of place where everyone knows everyone. And the brutal rape and murder of Wanda McCoy traumatized the town and the entire area. It wasn't just what happened to Wanda, but how the justice system and media manipulated the narrative of what really happened to her. On March 10th, 1981, at 2:15 p.m., Brad McCoy bid his wife goodbye for the afternoon and the better part of the evening. He wouldn't know until much later that this goodbye would be the last time he saw her alive. He was headed to his usual shift at United Coal Shop No. 1, where he worked above ground as a parts clerk in the repair shop. Brad was fortunate to be one of the men in town that was employed by the coal company, but not positioned within a narrow tunnel, pit, or shaft. He usually left for work around that time in order to make the short drive to the shop, but never liked saying goodbye to his wife, Wanda. Wanda hated being alone in their modest home while Brad was away at work. It frightened her to be by herself late at night. She knew to expect a phone call sometime later in the evening, usually around 9 p.m., when Brad took his required break. He would always call and check on her and remind her that in just 2 short hours, he would return home so they could settle in together. That night, just as Wanda expected, the phone rang around 9 o'clock. Brad was on break and checking in on her. The couple chatted for around 10 to 15 minutes. They talked about how they would spend their upcoming tax return and about how Brad's shift was going, and then said their second goodbyes of the night. Brad finished his shift at 11 p.m. and then headed out, arriving home around 11:15. As he pulled into the driveway, he noticed that the front porch light wasn't on, causing him to pause for a moment. Wanda usually left the light on for him. Brad knocked on the door, expecting Wanda to greet him, as usual. When she didn't, he tried the storm door, which was unlocked. He used his house key to unlock the second wooden door. As he entered the living room, Brad noticed that the TV was on, but Wanda wasn't nearby. While that wasn't out of the ordinary, the next thing he noticed immediately alarmed him. The coffee table had been moved, and there were drops of blood on the floor. He called out for Wanda, hoping to see her appear from their room with her signature easy smile and bouncy, strawberry blonde hair. But the house was silent. He walked through the living room and into their bedroom, still calling Wanda's name. On the bedroom floor, Brad found his beloved wife. Her hair covered her face, and beneath her head there was a pool of blood. He could make out at least one wound in the middle of her chest and noticed that her arms were raised behind her head, her legs sticking straight out apart. without touching his wife. Brad said later he knew that she was dead. In shock, he called his father and told him that Wanda had been killed. Max Hezzy McCoy, Brad's father, lived about 500 yards away from his son and daughter-in-law. After getting the call from his son that something horrible had happened to Wanda, he rushed over to their house. Brad initially turned on the porch light, waiting on his father to get to the house. But he was overcome with emotion and decided to run and meet him instead. He told his dad about how he had come home and found his wife's body. Hezzy called the sheriff's department at 11:21 p.m. to report what his son had seen. Then the two men walked back into the home to briefly check Wanda's body. Sadly, they confirmed Brad's beautiful young wife was dead, and they waited outside to meet the officers who had begun to arrive. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Wanda Faye Thompson was born to parents Margie and Samuel Thompson on November 5, 1961. She was the second youngest of 16 children, 8 boys and 8 girls. Her father was a retired coal miner, and though they had a simple life, the family was very close and warm. Wanda was known to be sweet and kind, but incredibly shy. She was close with her parents and all of her siblings, and she liked to sew. She made clothes and other crafts as a hobby. Wanda enjoyed going to class at the local high school, but she kept her circle small. It was there at Grundy High School that she met Brad McCoy. Brad was slight of build, with a sharp mind and calm temperament, and known to be a soft-spoken, stand-up guy. He was a hard worker, and like his father and Wanda's dad, planned to one day work at the mines in town. Brad was 2 years ahead of Wanda in school and worked part-time at the Piggly Wiggly to make some extra cash. One of his co-workers, Wanda's older sister Linda, actually introduced the two. Before long, the couple was going steady. And in 1978, after Brad graduated high school, they decided to get married. The ceremony was at Brad's childhood place of worship, Grundy Baptist Church, with their parents and families in attendance. Brad was 18 and Wanda was 16 years old at the time. The legal age of marriage in Virginia is 18 today, unless you have a parent's consent. I was unable to find when exactly that age was set, as marital ages have varied greatly over the years in the United States. But clearly, Wanda's parents approved of the match and consented if 16 was not the legal age in 1978. And we need to try not to judge with our 2021 eyes. They were 2 years apart at a time when many couples married very young, often right out of high school. Wanda and Brad just didn't want to wait. Wanda dropped out of school, initially planning to re-enroll that upcoming fall. Brad got his job working second shift, 3 p.m. to 11 p.m. at the mine, and the couple rented a house on the outskirts of Grundy on Slate Creek. But Wanda enjoyed being a homemaker and changed her mind about returning to school. She and Brad were able to live a comfortable but humble life on his salary, and she enjoyed taking care of their home, cooking, and happily sewing and crafting. Their home was next to Slate Creek and within walking distance of Brad's parents' home. They wanted to be close to at least one of their families, and the proximity of Brad's job to the Long Bottom neighborhood where they rented their small house was the best choice. The young couple was well-liked, friendly with neighbors, and said to have been a perfect match. Because of this, the police on the scene that night of March 10th were in disbelief at what had happened to 19-year-old Wanda McCoy. At 11:25 p.m., just 4 minutes after Brad McCoy and his father called the authorities, a sergeant and an additional officer from the Buchanan Sheriff's Department had arrived at the Long Bottom home. The sergeant attempted to check Wanda's body for a pulse, but was unable to, due to the gaping wounds in her chest and the state of her neck. Other local and state police made their way to the McCoy home, where one officer was able to confirm that although Wanda's wrist was warm, she had no pulse. The medical examiner was called in as the crew there began to secure the premises of the home and surrounding area. Part of this effort included measuring the level of the nearby Slate Creek, which was reportedly at 10 to 12 inches. Bloodstains on the wall and floor of the living room were found, along with what looked like drag marks leading from the living room floor to the nearby bedroom. Just 10 minutes later, at 11:35 p.m., the medical examiner arrived and officially confirmed that Wanda was dead. He began to conduct a preliminary examination of Wanda's body, but waited to touch or move her until the Special Investigations Unit arrived. Wanda was partially clothed, with her sweater pushed up around her upper body and her underwear hanging off of her left ankle. There was a dark, fine substance found on her hands and a paper towel nearby her body. Investigators suspected that the dark substance might have been coal dust, but couldn't be certain until actual testing was complete. There was a large laceration on her neck and two puncture wounds in her chest. The neck wound was determined to be the cause of death, running so deeply that the young woman had almost been decapitated. The medical examiner noted that Wanda's body was still warm and that rigor mortis had not set in. He estimated that she had been killed around 10:30 p.m., give or take 30 minutes. Investigators on the scene spoke to neighbors, hoping that they had seen or heard anything during the night that could point them towards the suspect. There was no evidence of a forced entry. One neighbor told police that she had taken her trash out for the evening at around 10:30 p.m. and saw the porch light on at the McCoy's house. Which is important, because when Brad arrived home about 45 minutes later, the porch light was off. A full autopsy was conducted on Wanda McCoy 2 days later on March 12th in nearby Roanoke. The examiner listed the slash wound to the neck as the cause of her death. The right carotid artery, jugular vein, and larynx. The examiner also found that Wanda had suffered two stab wounds to the chest. One had penetrated the heart and lung. There was little to no bleeding from this wound, so the examiner concluded that it had been inflicted after Wanda was already dead. The other chest wound had penetrated the liver and was thought to have been inflicted closer to the time of Wanda's death. He described the neck wound as a single cut, 2 to 3 inches in depth, without hesitation marks, leading from the right side of the neck to the left and downward. During the examination, the doctor found two foreign hairs in Wanda's genital area. These hairs and a sample of her own hair were sent for forensic testing. The examiner also submitted swabs from Wanda's vagina, rectum, hands, and mouth, her underwear, and samples of her blood for testing. Because there was no forced entry to the home, Brad made it a point to tell the investigators that Wanda was far too shy and fearful of being alone in the house at night to have ever opened the door for a stranger. Initially, the investigators in the case had several persons of interest that they were looking at, including the usual suspects of family and people that knew Wanda and her husband. Brad McCoy was quickly ruled out as a suspect, as investigators immediately verified that he was at work when his wife was attacked. One of the persons of interest was a man named Roger Keith Coleman, the husband of Wanda's younger sister, Tricia. The Colemans lived about 5 minutes down the road from Wanda and Brad, with Roger's grandmother in her trailer. He had several run-ins with the law in his past and had even spent time in prison. This history and his connection to Wanda immediately placed him on the detective's radar. State police officers spoke with Coleman the day following the discovery of Wanda's body. He gave an account of where he had been the previous evening, including leaving his home at 8:30 p.m. to visit a local convenience store, running a few other errands, and then reporting to his shift at TJ&M Coal Company. Coleman told officers that when he arrived for work, he was told that he wasn't needed that evening. So at 10:50 p.m., he stopped at a bathhouse in town to shower up and change his clothes before returning home. The bathhouse was in the basement of a local barbershop in town. It was typical of miners to stop in the bathhouse after their shifts to attempt to wash off some of the coal dust and dirt on their bodies before tracking it back into their homes. Police asked Coleman to show them the clothes he had worn the previous night. He gave them a plastic bag of clothing containing a pair of dirty blue jeans with damp pant legs. They measured the dampness, noting that the moisture reached up to about 10 to 12 inches on the legs, the same height as Slate Creek. The clothing was sent to the Roanoke Bureau of Forensic Sciences for testing. The following day, investigators interviewed Coleman again. As they had the previous day, the officers failed to read Coleman his Miranda rights, which they later justified by stating that Coleman was not an accused suspect yet and was just a part of their investigation. The investigator speaking with Coleman wanted an explanation for the water found on his blue jeans, the ones he wore the night of Wanda's murder. Coleman said that the water could have come from the mine, but the detective told him they had already checked the mine and found no source of water. Then Coleman said he could have accidentally laid the jeans in water while he was bathing at the bathhouse that night. During this conversation, Coleman also gave police a knife at their request. On March 13th, the same investigators met with Coleman at his in-law's home to request a sample of his bodily fluids and hair. While there, the investigator stated to Coleman that he had the choice to require a warrant for the search. Coleman waived his right and signed a consent form for the search of his body, including the removal of any property or fluids. Samples of Coleman's blood, head, and pubic hairs, and saliva were taken and sent to the forensics lab in Roanoke. 5 weeks into the investigation, and after Wanda McCoy's murder, investigators arrested 23-year-old Coleman. Roger Keith Coleman had a troubled past, starting at an early age. He was raised primarily by his grandmother, Garnett Coleman, and had lived with her most of his life. Garnett officially adopted Coleman when he was 14 years old, around the age that some of his problematic behavior started. When he was just 13, Coleman started harassing his female classmates over the phone. In a 2006 A&E documentary on Coleman, some of these former classmates detailed how the teen would make lewd and inappropriate phone calls to their houses. One classmate told A&E, quote, "When he called, he described sexual acts that he would like to perform with me. If my sister answered the phone, he would ask her the same questions." Coleman would call these sisters and other classmates repeatedly, describing disturbing sexual fantasies. Eventually, he landed in juvenile court because of the calls, where he admitted to the acts but blamed them on the voices in his head. In 1977, Coleman attempted to rape a 36-year-old woman named Brenda Reif. On that day, flooding caused Brenda, a schoolteacher, to stay home with her 6-year-old daughter while her husband left for work. This was the last major flood in the area that I talked about, and it had caused the county to lose power and phone services. Coleman, then 19 years old, knocked on Brenda's door and asked for a glass of water. She kindly let Coleman inside, and then he pulled a gun on her. He forced her to tape her daughter's hands and feet together and put her in a rocking chair. He forced Brenda upstairs and ordered her to disrobe, but she refused. He ripped off her bathrobe and began his assault, but Brenda fought back hard and was able to wriggle out from under him when he reached for his gun. She grabbed her daughter and ran out of the house before Coleman caught her and tried to drag her back inside. But again, Brenda was able to disarm Coleman. She threw his gun under the porch and then began screaming for help. Neighbors quickly responded to her screams, and Coleman ran from the scene, but he was soon apprehended. Following the attack, he was convicted of the attempted rape and sentenced to serve 3 years in the state penitentiary, but he only served a little over 2 years. By 1980, Roger Coleman's life had seemingly stabilized a bit, but of course, looks can be deceiving. He was out of the state pen, and he met Patricia Thompson, Wanda McCoy's little sister. She went by the nickname Trisha. The couple quickly got married. Trisha was just 17 years old in 1981, the year her sister was murdered, and she and her husband had an age gap of 6 years. Like I said, Trisha and Roger lived with his grandmother in a trailer, which was located near the Long Bottom neighborhood where Brad and Wanda lived. Trisha and Roger's brother-in-law, Brad McCoy, were shocked by his arrest. Brad was skeptical that a man he had grown up playing sandlot games with could be capable of brutalizing and killing his own sister-in-law. He believed at first that Roger had been wrongly accused of the rape and murder. Wanda had always treated the man as family, and they had never had any problems with him in the past. In the days following Wanda's murder, Roger Coleman had even served as a pallbearer in her funeral. 2 months before Wanda McCoy's murder in January of 1981, Coleman walked into the Buchanan County Public Library, where two women were closing up for the evening. These two women, Patricia Hatfield and Jean Gilbert, had been finishing up last-minute tasks when Coleman entered the library and began masturbating in front of them, eventually ejaculating on one of the desks. Though they were, of course, disgusted by the crude act, what really shook Hatfield, as she told the Herald Courier, was the cold and dead look in the man's eyes. Patricia Hatfield called the police, and Coleman ran off before they could stop him. Despite the crime that had just been committed, the police told Patricia that it was likely not serious and that instead, the man had probably just done it for shock value. Jean Gilbert, an artist, sketched a drawing of what the man looked like, and later on, at the suggestion of an officer, she and Patricia compared the photo to past yearbooks in the town. They recognized the man from their memories and the sketch as Roger Keith Coleman. A week following Wanda's murder and before he was arrested, Coleman returned to the library, where Patricia and Jean were still working. Patricia chillingly recalled that he was reading books that he pulled from the Forensics and Code of Virginia sections. She and Jean notified the police that they believed that they had identified Roger Coleman as the man from the library incident. But before an investigation could start or charges be pressed, Coleman was arrested and charged with Wanda's murder. Patricia Hatfield was pained at the news of a young woman in her community being brutally killed, and she never doubted that Roger Coleman was capable of such a crime. She told the Herald Courier, quote, "If somebody had taken the library thing seriously, this might not have happened. I always felt like I did the best job I could convincing the men that they were dealing with a psychopath. And these guys are all good guys, nice people, trying to do the right thing. But they were wrong on this." I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. I love makeup, and I love looking my best. But as I've gotten older, my priorities have changed. I have less time in front of the mirror, and I'm more concerned with long-term skincare. That's why I'm loving Thrive Cosmetics. Their clinically proven formulas not only highlight your best features, they actually improve your skin over time. Thrive Cosmetics is dedicated to strict, clean beauty standards. All their products are made with clean, high-performance, skin-loving ingredients formulated without parabens, sulfates, or phthalates. And Thrive Cosmetics never test on animals. They are PETA and Leaping Bunny approved, certified as 100% vegan and cruelty-free. Thrive Cosmetics also has a bold, bigger-than-beauty mission. For every product purchased, Thrive Cosmetics donates to causes that help women thrive. Women who are fighting cancer, emerging from homelessness, and surviving domestic violence. As you know, intimate partner abuse is a cause very close to my heart, so it means a lot to me to know a product I'm buying supports that cause and many others. I've bought several Thrive products, but their Liquid Lash Extensions Mascara is Thrive's top-selling product for a reason. My eyes popped and looked like I had grown longer lashes overnight. Visit ThriveCosmetics.com/SouthernFried for 15% off your first order. This is an exclusive offer you can only get here. That's Thrive, C-O-U-S-E. medics.com/southernfried for 15% off your first order. That's thrivecosmetics.com/southernfried. Are you carrying a high credit card balance month after month? You're not the only one. 40% of American families are stuck in some cycle of debt. The high interest rates make it hard to pay off debt, but the lending platform Upstart can help. Upstart is the fast and easy way to pay off your debt with a personal loan, all online. Unlike other lenders, Upstart looks at more than just your credit score, like your income and employment history, giving a more holistic view of your credit worthiness, which means Upstart can offer smarter rates with trusted partners. Whether you are paying off credit cards, consolidating high interest debt, or funding personal expenses, join the 500,000 people who have used Upstart to get a simple fixed monthly payment. With just a 5-minute online rate check, you can see your rate upfront for loans between $1,000 to $50,000. And you can receive the funds as fast as one business day after accepting your loan. Find out how Upstart can lower your monthly payments today when you go to upstart.com/southernfried. That's upstart.com/southernfried. Don't forget to use our URL to let them know we sent you. Loan amounts will be determined based on your credit, income, and certain other information provided on your loan application. Go to upstart.com/southernfried. Roger Coleman was charged with the rape and capital murder of Wanda McCoy. Leading up to the trial, Coleman's defense team requested a change of venue, citing five local newspapers that had been widely circulated throughout the larger Buchanan County area about the case, and arguing that he could not receive an impartial trial. In response to this, the Commonwealth of Virginia presented affidavits from many different community members stating that they believed Coleman could receive a fair trial right there in Buchanan County. On January 5, 1982, Coleman's motion for a venue change was denied. Coleman notified the court in the form of a letter on February 15th that he was not satisfied with his attorney's efforts to obtain a change of venue. He wrote that his uncle was supposedly obtaining signatures on a petition stating that Coleman could not receive a fair trial in the county. The letter also mentioned a sign at a local gas station in Grundy that apparently read, in reference to the case, "Time for another hanging in Grundy." Roger Coleman also claimed that he had received threats of death or bodily harm. Despite his claim in the letter, no petition was ever filed with the court. 42 potential jurors were questioned in preparation for the trial. 14 were dismissed because they had already formed an opinion about Coleman's guilt or innocence, and 8 were removed because of their unwavering belief that the death penalty should never, under any circumstances, be carried out. Virginia is a death penalty state, and this was a capital murder. At this point, the Commonwealth prosecutors were unwilling to take it off the table. Coleman again requested a change of venue, but was denied. The judge stated that Coleman's defense would have leniency in individual voir dire of the 20 potential jurors remaining. This meant that Coleman's counsel and the judge could individually examine any juror they deemed questionable. One prospective juror was removed on this basis. Once the final decisions were made, the jury was sequestered at a local motel. Coleman's trial began in April of 1982. At the start of his trial, Coleman's defense objected to the statements he made during the first two conversations with investigators on March 11th and 12th being made admissible in court. The judge overruled this objection, stating that the officers made the proper choice of not reading Coleman his rights, seeing as the man was free to leave at any time and was not under arrest during those conversations. The forensic serologist who analyzed the hairs found in Wanda's genital area testified that the hairs did not belong to Wanda and instead were consistent with hairs taken from Coleman. The serologist stated that the hairs were most likely Coleman's, but admitted that a person of the same race whose hair had the same color, diameter, and general configuration and microscopic characteristics could have left the hairs as well, but he emphasized that this was unlikely. Since the 1980s, hair analysis evidence has been widely discredited, but a lot of the blood evidence in this case is still compelling. According to the serologist, Roger Coleman was a secretor, someone whose blood type factor is present in their semen, saliva, or other bodily fluids. The serologist testified that 80 to 85% of the population are secretors. Coleman had the more rare blood type B, possessed by only 10% of the population, while Wanda had type O blood, found in about 45% of the population. Brad McCoy was type A. As part of his testimony, the serologist stated that he had collected sperm found in Wanda's vagina, and upon testing the substance, had determined that the specimen was left from a secretor with blood type B. Of course, with this being 1982, DNA testing was not yet available. Forensic testing during the trial also presented blood stains found on the pants that Coleman was wearing the night of Wanda's murder. The blood was type O, matching Wanda's blood type. Coleman's jeans also had a blackish stain on the upper pants leg, appearing to match the dark substance found on Wanda's hands and resembling coal dust. The knife that Coleman had provided to the police was tested for blood and mentioned at trial. The blade did have trace amounts of blood on it, but there wasn't enough of a sample to determine if the blood came from a human or animal. The owner of Speedy Market, the convenience store that Coleman claimed to stop at, on the night of Wanda's murder, testified in court that Coleman had entered his store around 8 p.m. that evening and stayed for about 10 minutes. An acquaintance of Coleman also testified that around 10:15 or 10:20 that evening, Coleman had swung by his house to get a videotape that his wife had borrowed from him. Gary Stiltner was supposed to have been at his shift during this time, but had decided to not go to work. After getting the tape back, Coleman left. Gary's wife, Sandra, testified that she looked at the clock as Coleman left, and it was 10:20. Her testimony corroborated her husband's testimony, but she also told the court about an incident that had happened 4 days before Wanda's murder. According to Sandra, Roger Coleman came around after her husband had left for his afternoon shift. She was hanging out with another neighbor, and Roger asked her about the tape she had borrowed. When her neighbor stepped out for a moment, Coleman pressed Sandra about what kind of drinks she liked, mentioning that he would get her anything she liked. Sandra declined and left to rejoin her neighbor. Prosecutors theorized at trial that Coleman had actually planned to rape Sandra Stiltner the night of Wanda's murder. But his plan was thwarted when her husband, who was supposed to be at work, answered the door. When Gary Stiltner opened the door, Coleman offered the excuse that he was stopping by to pick up that videotape. The prosecution also theorized that this change of plans had resulted in Coleman deciding to attack Wanda McCoy. According to the Commonwealth, Coleman had parked his truck across from Slate Creek in the McCoy house, raped and murdered Wanda, and then fled across the shallow stream to avoid being seen by neighbors. This would explain why the bottom of his pants legs were wet. A convicted felon that shared a cell block with Coleman while he awaited trial testified that Coleman had described the rape and murder of Wanda to him, drawing the scene on a newspaper. According to the felon, Coleman told him that he and another man were inside the house that evening, and it was the other man who actually slashed and stabbed Wanda. The inmate said Coleman told him that he and the other man both raped Wanda before killing her. The accomplice was supposedly named Danny Ray or something similar to that, but no accomplice of that name was ever found or identified. Following this testimony, Coleman's defense moved to strike the evidence that had been presented in relation to the charge of capital murder, stating that the felon's testimony showed that he had not delivered a fatal blow to Wanda, which is really interesting. So assuming what he told the felon was true, his team is admitting he was there that night and raped Wanda. He just didn't murder her. This was an idiotic argument to make and counter to everything that they had submitted as his alibi for that night. And it was not accepted by the judge. Coleman's defense team said that the Commonwealth had nothing but circumstantial evidence tying Coleman to the crime and tried to poke holes in their proposed timeline of events. Roger Coleman testified in his own defense, repeating the same timeline of his night on March 10th that he had originally told investigators. He complained about the detectives, quote, "It seemed like they came just about every other day, sometimes every day, for 3 or 4 days in a row." He claimed that everything he told them was in an effort to clear himself of further suspicion and in good faith. He acknowledged that in his travels between Looney Creek, Boyd's Trailer Park, and the bathhouse that night, he had passed by the McCoy's residence, but insisted that he did not stop there. He told the court that he didn't even learn about Wanda's murder until around midnight, when his sister-in-law came to his grandmother's house to tell them the news. Coleman denied that he had ever confessed to Wanda's rape and murder to the felon that testified, or any other inmates for that matter. He also said that a man named Randall Jackson had told his uncle about the paper towel at the crime scene, attempting to explain how he knew about a piece of evidence that had not been publicized, a statement that Jackson later denied on the stand. The Commonwealth had introduced the paper towel as evidence found near Wanda's body. Rejecting the felon's claims, according to Coleman, he simply relayed the information he had learned about the murder from his family to his fellow inmates. Convicted felons commonly called jailhouse snitches, aren't always given a lot of credence in court, especially if they leveraged their testimony for their own benefit. It is unclear if this felon received anything for his testimony, but regardless, a good defense attorney would have rejected and ignored his testimony completely. They shouldn't have tried to use it to get out of the capital murder charge, and Roger Coleman should have just denied any conversations with the felon. They really just dug their own holes by engaging with the felon's testimony. During cross-examination, Coleman acknowledged that he knew the hours of Brad McCoy's shift and that he was aware that on March 10, 1981, Brad would not be returning home until after 11 p.m. When he was asked how type O blood had gotten on the pants leg of his jeans, Coleman suggested that his cat could have scratched someone at his home, or he could have encountered someone in the mine that was bleeding from a scrape or cut. His wife, Tricia, denied knowing about their cat scratching anyone, but still, Coleman denied that the blood had come from Wanda and suggested that the blood on his knife had come from squirrels he had caught. Tricia Coleman testified that her husband left their residence for work sometime between 8 and 8:30 p.m. A witness confirmed seeing Coleman at the Speedy Market at around 8 o'clock the night of the murder and testified that he spoke with Coleman for 10 to 15 minutes. A night watchman from TJ&M Coal Company, Coleman's workplace, testified that he saw Coleman at Breeding's store at 9:25. Upon seeing him in his work clothes, the watchman notified Coleman that he had been laid off from his shift and accompanied him to the mines so that Coleman could gather his belongings. He left sometime between 9:30 and 9:45 p.m. The second shift foreman at TJ&M Coal Company testified that he saw Coleman around 10 p.m. carrying his work boots and hat out of the mine. The foreman stated that he didn't believe Coleman's pants were wet at the time. Another mine worker met Coleman at the opening of the mouth of Looney's Creek at 10:10 p.m. and then spoke with Coleman for about 10 or 15 minutes. It was 4 miles from the mouth of Looney Creek to the McCoy home. Another witness placed Coleman sitting alone in his truck sometime between 10 and 11 p.m. Tricia Coleman admitted that she was unsure of the exact time that her husband returned home that night, but she did remember that when he arrived, Roger had explained to her that he was home early because he had been laid off. Tricia stated that the night before the murder, the couple had visited the McCoys so that she could return some recipes to Wanda. During that visit, Roger remained in the truck outside. According to Tricia, she and her husband frequently visited the McCoy home, and it wasn't uncommon for the couple to stay with Wanda sometimes while Brad McCoy was away at work. Coleman's grandmother testified that he had left their home at around 8:30 for work and returned at 11:05 p.m. She had previously told an investigator that Coleman had gotten home at 11:30 p.m., but she stated to the court that she had been mistaken. In closing arguments, the prosecution restated and emphasized their theory that Coleman had changed his plans that night after being laid off of work and had decided to rape Sandra Stiltner when he knew her husband would be at work. They theorized that Coleman, after being run off at the sight of Sandra Stiltner's husband being home, had to resort to a backup plan, raping Wanda McCoy, his sister-in-law, whom he knew would be alone that night. Based on those who knew her well, Wanda would not have opened the door for a stranger, but her brother-in-law, a man that she trusted, there was no doubt that Wanda would have felt comfortable opening the door at his knock. According to the Commonwealth, Coleman had brutally cut Wanda's throat, raped her, and then stabbed her twice in the chest for good measure. The defense rejected this idea entirely. Coleman's attorneys described how he had never had any ill will towards Brad or Wanda McCoy. They argued that even if he had, there was no way that Coleman could have committed such a heinous crime in such a short time span. They pointed to the testimony of several witnesses who had seen him around town that night, in and around the suggested time of Wanda's murder, and argued that though he had trouble with law in the past, he wasn't a murderer. We know that eyewitness testimony is often shaky, especially if it's just some guy you know, not family or a close friend. You probably wouldn't know at the exact time unless you were suspicious for some reason or you didn't know the man well. The Commonwealth's case was really circumstantial, but it was compelling. The jury of Coleman's peers deliberated for 3 hours and 30 minutes after the closing arguments on March 18th. At around 11 p.m., they had made up their minds. Roger Keith Coleman was found guilty of rape and capital murder. The following morning, before his sentencing, Coleman's defense motioned for the guilty verdict to be set aside. The defense claimed that the evidence against him was insufficient. The motion was denied. Several witnesses, both for the Commonwealth of Virginia and the defense, were called to testify on Coleman's behalf in hopes to either lengthen or lessen his sentencing. In the state of Virginia, in capital cases where the death penalty is on the table, the Commonwealth is allowed to present unadjudicated bad acts, meaning any allegation that the defendant has done something criminal in the past, regardless of whether he was charged or convicted. In turn, the defendant is allowed to present any aspect of his character, history, or background that can be argued to be mitigating. The defense called two witnesses during this process, both of which were ministers. One of the men, the jail chaplain, spoke about Coleman's religious values. The other minister had known Coleman when he was a child, but admitted that he had not been in contact with him in his adult years. After Coleman was first arrested, the minister began visiting him and, upon Coleman's request, performed a baptism for him. For the second time, Coleman testified on his own behalf. He said he didn't think it mattered whether the sentencing was for the death penalty or for life in prison and said, "It's up to the Lord now anyway." Patricia Hatfield, one of the women who was present the night that Coleman had masturbated in the public library, wasn't called to testify during the sentencing. It was believed that Brenda Reif's testimony, the victim of Coleman's attempted rape, would be sufficient, and they were right. Brenda's testimony captured the cruelty of Roger Coleman, who had preyed on the school teacher's kindness and attempted to rape her with her 6-year-old daughter present in the home. Following these testimonies, Roger Keith Coleman was sentenced to life in prison for the rape and received a death sentence for the murder of Wanda Faye McCoy. I'm going to pause now for a final word from today's sponsors. Over the last year, like many of you, I've enjoyed the comfy clothes, but summer is upon us, and if you're like me, I bet you're ready to dress up again. And yet, we don't want to lose that comfort for style. Southern Tide is a lifestyle apparel brand that offers the best of both worlds, comfort and style. Many of the fabrics they use offer performance features such as sun protection and moisture management, so these clothes are ready for all of your fun summer outdoor plans. Speaking of outdoors, they just launched their Red, White, and Tide collection, which is absolutely perfect for all of your Memorial Day and 4th of July parties. Another great thing about Southern Tide is that they offer clothes for men, women, and kids. So if you're looking for a gift for yourself or for upcoming Father's Day, then they have you covered. And it's not just clothes and swimsuits. They've got awesome beach towels and all kinds of cool accessories like purses, hats, and even Yeti brand gear. And the best part is, Southern Tide is offering a special 20% off discount for all of the Southern Fried True Crime listeners. Just use promo code SOUTHERNFRIED20. I think you're going to love Southern Tide's unique collections. Check out the site at SouthernTide.com and don't forget to use my promo code SOUTHERNFRIED20. Is there something bothering you? Sometimes my anxiety can make me just freeze up. It interferes with my productivity. BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for us. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states, treating depression, anxiety, stress, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. The service is also available to clients worldwide. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. And you can send a message to your counselor at any time. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses, and you can schedule weekly sessions with your counselor by video or phone, whichever makes you more comfortable. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so it is easy and free to change counselors if you want to, and anything you share is confidential. BetterHelp is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and there is even financial aid available. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/southern. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/southern. Roger Coleman's sentencing was met with outrage from many people who lived outside of Grundy and Buchanan County, who were persuaded by his declarations of innocence. Slowly, from his prison cell, Coleman had gained a formidable group of supporters across the nation who believed he would be put to death for a crime he didn't commit. The Supreme Court of Virginia affirmed his convictions and sentences a little over a year after his initial sentencing on September 9, 1983. He then filed a petition for a writ of habeas corpus in the circuit court on April 26, 1984, citing ineffective counsel, trial error, and misconduct by the state during pretrial discovery. The appeal was again denied. 5 years after receiving a death sentence, Coleman reached out to a man named Jim McCloskey, who became an adamant and vocal supporter of Coleman's innocence. McCloskey had attended a program for ministry after working as a successful businessman for many years. McCloskey became interested in helping those that were facing death for possible wrongful convictions. He founded Centurion Ministries, an organization dedicated to investigating claims of wrongful death convictions and advocating for men and women on death row. By the time that Coleman got McCloskey's attention in 1988, Centurion Ministries had already aided in the release of nearly a dozen people who had been wrongly convicted, several of whom were on death row. Coleman and McCloskey grew close after their initial conversation, and McCloskey's support of the convicted killer was unwavering. While awaiting his death, Coleman kept a prison diary in which he often wrote about his innocence and distrust of the judicial system. McCloskey and a new legal team, this one working the case pro bono, thanks to the growing support of Coleman's claims of innocence, continued to work to free the convicted rapist and murderer. Roger Coleman and his legal team eventually appealed to the federal court, but missed the deadline to file the appeal by 1 day. The United States Supreme Court, after much deliberation, ruled that the missed deadline, as specified in law, mattered, and that the right to an appeal had been forfeited. Coleman's supporters, including McCloskey, helped raise media concerns about the sentencing, and soon he became the poster boy for potential false convictions. Coleman appeared on PBS, Larry King Live, Nightline, The Today Show, and Good Morning America. "Every minute of my time that night has been accounted for," Roger Coleman insisted to Bryant Gumbel on The Today Show. A former Bristol Herald Courier reporter who covered the ongoing media circus around Coleman's conviction and claims of innocence, Kathy Still, later told the Herald Courier, quote, "I did see the media bias, and I did see how the PR machine started working for Coleman. Wanda was totally forgotten, and the library encounter was never mentioned because that would go against their objectives. They had their agenda. They interviewed who they wanted to." That, of course, was true. The media that circulated about Coleman and the investigators from Centurion Ministries did not speak with Brenda Reif or Patricia Hatfield, both previous victims of Coleman's. Brenda Reif said in the A&E documentary about the case, quote, "I couldn't understand why they didn't talk to me or why my word was not as good as his. They didn't want anything to do with me." In fact, McCloskey used the local public library, where Patricia Hatfield was still employed, to research the case on Coleman's behalf, yet he never tried talking to Hatfield about her experience with Coleman. Patricia Hatfield told the Herald Courier, quote, "Never once did he say, 'I'd like to talk to you all.' And I kept thinking, if he really wants the truth, why wouldn't he sit down and talk to me?" The whole frustration was being touted as less than, not only from being a woman, but from being from the Appalachian region. That's not just tunnel vision on McCloskey's part. That's purposely ignoring evidence about Roger Coleman's character and criminal past. Besides appearing in the media and working on a way to get off death row, Coleman spent his spare time in prison looking for people to talk with. He started a group while on death row called The Choice Is Yours, which was meant to counsel youth on how to make better choices and avoid ending up in jail. According to a Newport News article from 2003, Coleman had even had an opportunity to be a part of a successful jail escape plan in 1984, but he declined to join the other inmates in their attempt because he said he was innocent and his lawyers would find a way to get him out. In the time following Coleman's arrest for her older sister's murder, Tricia, his wife, filed for divorce. After placing an ad in the University of Virginia student newspaper looking for pen pals, Coleman got the attention of a sophomore at the college named Sharon Paul. The two became pen pals, and soon Sharon was in love with the convicted murderer and rapist. They shared many letters, and Coleman even purchased small gifts for the young woman. They even talked about having children. Sharon became one of Coleman's fiercest supporters, believing fully that he was innocent and holding out hope that he would manage to be freed. By 1990, DNA testing had gained footing as a new but reliable source of forensic science. At the encouragement of his legal team and McCloskey, a DNA test was arranged that year in hopes that it could prove once and for all whether Coleman had been responsible for Rhonda McCoy's rape and murder. Because the science was still new in 1990, the test was performed in the primitive stages of DNA. Still, the test came back with results, indicating that two men contributed to the semen sample taken from Wanda McCoy. Brad McCoy had testified during the original trial that he had sex with his wife about 48 hours before her murder. The combination of samples was too muddled for DNA science at the time to definitively confirm if one of the contributors was Roger Coleman. As time went on between Coleman's sentencing and his awaited execution date, rumors began to swirl in Grundy and in the media about another suspect, a man that many believed was responsible for Wanda's murder and the attack on several other nearby women. In early 1991, a 23-year-old woman named Teresa Horn, who lived just outside of Grundy, told the local news team that another man had attacked her and confessed to playing a role in the murder of Wanda McCoy. Horn, who had struggled with drug addiction in the past, died the day after this interview, the result of a drug overdose. After Horn's death, three other witnesses came forward, stating that they had heard the suspect bragging about aiding in Wanda McCoy's murder. The man, a neighbor of Wanda and Brad's, who lived about 60 feet up the slope of the hill where their home rested, denied these accusations and maintained that he had nothing to do with Wanda's murder. Coleman's legal team used this information to appeal to the courts that new information was available in the case. But the man was never charged. Not only did he have an alibi for the time of the murder, his blood type did not match the blood type of the semen found in Wanda's body. The courts rejected Coleman's claim of new evidence, and those closest to Wanda never wavered in their beliefs that Roger Coleman was guilty. Brad McCoy told reporters, "I'll never change my mind. He took something from me that I loved very much, and he's still taking from me and everyone else in this state while he's alive in that prison." In December of 1991, the judge in Coleman's case dismissed Coleman's legal team's petition implicating the other man, and 2 months later, he set Coleman's execution date for May 20th, 1992. Adding to the international coverage of Coleman's upcoming execution, on May 8th, 1992, Coleman made the cover of Time magazine. The headline printed over his picture read, in caps, "This man might be innocent. This man is due to die." Not everyone was convinced by Coleman and his band of supporters, though. In her book, Deceiving Innocence, Donna Moore, a clinical psychologist, points out that Coleman viciously murdered his sister-in-law and then went home to his wife, acting as if things were totally normal. She wrote, "It suggested you were dealing with a serious psychopath." Psychopaths cannot experience remorse or empathy with the victim. I couldn't agree more, and it is very rare for a defendant in a capital murder case to testify on his own behalf. Even people who have later been exonerated were counseled not to testify. It's just too easy for a gifted prosecutor to twist your words and get you agitated on the stand. It takes nerves of steel to get up and lie like that in court. It's not something most people can do. A psychopath can, though. The Commonwealth's prosecution team, Patricia Hatfield, Jean Gilbert, Brad McCoy, and Brenda Reif, all journeyed to Richmond in support of Coleman's execution, appearing in front of a special counsel responsible for deciding whether to proceed with the execution. Patricia Hatfield was finally able to testify about her ordeal in the public library for the first time in front of the special counsel. Thomas Scott, one of the prosecutors in the case, told reporters, quote, "Coleman had an IQ of 140 or higher and was extremely convincing. In fact, he was probably the smartest inmate ever to serve on death row, including Ted Bundy. As a consequence, he became a media darling and America's capital punishment poster boy." Exactly. He was an incredibly smart psychopath who was gifted at manipulating people. Brad McCoy told the media, quote, "We tried to set the story straight, but no one ever really listened to us. The media had decided that Coleman was the victim. No one ever really understood that Wanda was the real victim." Brad McCoy even consented to appear on the Today Show to confront his former brother-in-law. When asked by the host if he had anything to say to Coleman, Brad replied, "Yes, I would like to ask him why he did it, and I would also like to ask him to admit it." Unlike in other settings and media appearances, this appeared to finally rattle Roger Coleman, who responded, "I did not kill Wanda, Brad. I didn't have anything to do with it. And if you'd open your eyes and look at the evidence we have now, evidence that the state has withheld, I mean, you just listened to what they've said and you bought their theory and you just closed your mind to everything we've uncovered." Virginia Governor Douglas Wilder received thousands of calls and letters urging leniency following the Times cover and the last-ditch efforts made by Coleman's legal and advocacy team. Leading up to the date, Coleman was interviewed by the Washington Post, still denying the crime. He said, "Every minute of my time that night was accounted for. I did not have 1 minute to spare, much less to walk across the creek, go up to her house, gain entry, overpower her, take her into the bedroom, disrobe her, rape her, eliminate all the evidence, walk back down the hill and wade the creek to where they said I hid my truck." Despite the urging of the public and thousands of supporters to commute or delay Coleman's execution, then-Governor Douglas Wilder refrained from acting. Even Pope John Paul II made a public plea for mercy, and Mother Teresa personally phoned the governor's chief counsel. Governor Wilder was unmoved. For his last meal, Roger Coleman suggested a Pizza Hut pizza, fudge cookies, and Sprite. The order was placed at a nearby Pizza Hut and reportedly arrived cold. Coleman told McCloskey he saw a positive side to his ordeal. He said, quote, "If I hadn't been wrongly convicted, I would be a nobody from Grundy for my entire life. And here I am. I've met Sharon. She means the world to me. I'm famous. My face is on Time magazine. I'm a somebody." Hours before the scheduled execution, Coleman had submitted to a polygraph test, which he promptly failed. In his final moments, he stated, "An innocent man is going to be murdered tonight. When my innocence is proven, I hope America will realize the injustice of the death penalty as all other civilized countries have." Despite all their efforts and public outcries, 33-year-old Roger Coleman was executed by electric chair on May 20, 1992, at the Greensville Correctional Center in Virginia. Following the execution, McCloskey read Coleman's last words to the media and cameras outside of the correctional center with a look of sorrow on his face. Coleman's supporters continued to support and advocate on his behalf years after his execution. Following her son's death, Roger Coleman's mother told reporters, quote, "They murdered my son just like someone murdered Wanda Faye McCoy. There is no legal system down here in Virginia. My son was innocent." In 2001, activists against the death penalty sued the state of Virginia and demanded that a DNA test be performed in an attempt to prove that Coleman was innocent in the Wanda McCoy murder case. DNA testing had come a long way in the decade that had passed since the first test was performed. The Virginia Supreme Court denied the request in 2002, but the fight was taken to then-Governor Mark Warner. After years of much public pressure, Governor Warner ordered a new DNA test on Coleman. According to the Washington Post, no sitting governor had ever agreed to allow DNA testing of an already executed man. In 2006, the results were finally available. The testing was conducted in a lab in Canada, an anti-death penalty country, in order to mitigate some of the skeptics who would inevitably distrust any results from the U.S. Jim McCloskey permitted a crew from ABC's Nightline to record his live reaction to the phone call from the Toronto Crime Lab that was performing the test. After the phone rang that morning, McCloskey talked with a representative of the lab for a short time and then looked shocked as he uttered two words, "He's guilty." Within hours of learning the DNA test results, McCloskey held a press conference and admitted he had been wrong all along and that Roger Coleman had betrayed his trust. McCloskey proclaimed the DNA test results as a victory for the truth, quote, "even though this particular truth feels like a kick in the stomach." Governor Mark Warner told reporters, "We have sought the truth using DNA technology not available at the time the Commonwealth carried out the ultimate criminal sanction." The confirmation that Roger Coleman's DNA was present reaffirms the verdict and the sanction. Again, my prayers are with the family of Wanda McCoy at this time. The results shocked onlookers around the nation, but the people of Grundy and Buchanan County, Virginia, weren't shocked by the news. They had always believed Coleman was guilty. Despite his initial admittance of error in trusting Roger Coleman, Jim McCloskey told the Bluefield Daily Telegraph in a September 2020 interview, quote, "To this day, I wrestle with, did Roger do this or did he not? I don't know. It's a dilemma that will follow me until the grave." In that same interview, McCloskey did not deny the fact that Coleman's semen, confirmed by the DNA test, was found in Wanda's body. Instead, he suggested that it could have come from consensual sex from a secret affair. It never ceases to amaze me or disgust me when people try to discredit a victim who cannot speak for herself by claiming she had some consensual affair. If that had been true, why didn't Coleman's defense team try that argument at trial? Jim McCloskey may have started his mission for the right reasons, but his agenda with Roger Coleman led him to denigrate Wanda McCoy's name decades after her brutal rape and murder. It's shameful and a discredit to the work done for real wrongful convictions. Brad McCoy eventually remarried and began a family with his new wife. Wanda McCoy's many siblings went on to get married, have children, and attempted to move on with their lives that had been shattered, not just by their sister's murder, but by the relentless media coverage and support of her murderer. Both Wanda's mother and father passed away in 2002 and 2005, respectively, so they sadly didn't live to see the DNA confirmation that proved Roger Coleman murdered their daughter. And the media coverage about the case of Roger Coleman certainly never benefited the people of the small town Grundy, Virginia. The coal dust-covered area, despite attempts at economic improvement, is today beset by a shriveling coal industry, a lack of jobs and resources for out-of-work or retired coal miners, and according to a 2015 article from The Atlantic, is one of the sickest towns in the United States. As the industry receded from the mountains and moved out west, The remaining folks in the area had been forced to look for opportunities elsewhere to support their families. The population has dwindled down to about 1,000 people in Grundy today. The men who spent their youthful years doing hard labor in the mines are now left to live off of Social Security and largely are unable to afford the cost of their medical care and needs. Perhaps in reaction to the 2015 article, today, the Town of Grundy webpage reads that they are, quote, striving to be the cleanest town in Virginia. Grundy is a peaceful town rich in natural resources and community pride. One of the worst parts of this case is the fact that, in an effort to debate the humanity of the death penalty, Roger Coleman was exalted as an innocent bystander in the justice system, when in reality, he is the monster that we fear. Coleman sexually harassed young girls he attended school with. He attempted to rape Brenda Reif in her home near her six-year-old daughter. He committed a disgusting and offensive act in front of Patricia Hatfield and Jean Gilbert, and he brutally raped and murdered Wanda Faye McCoy. He enjoyed scaring and hurting women. Roger Coleman was found to be an intelligent psychopath and a confident liar. And unfortunately, his statement to Jim McCloskey was right. He was a nobody from Grundy, Virginia, until his crimes made him a somebody in the national spotlight. Regardless of my opinion on the death penalty, I do wish they had waited to execute him until DNA science could conclusively prove he raped and murdered Wanda. I would like to have seen the look on his face when the results were revealed. Although I'm sure that smug son of a bitch would have further denigrated Wanda's name by claiming they had consensual sex. Wanda's family had waited 16 years for the science to improve after the first DNA test. And it was 25 years after her murder when they were finally able to prove that Roger Coleman had killed her. 25 years of his lies. 25 years of a biased media, completely ignoring the real victim in this case, 19-year-old Wanda Faye McCoy, the happily married, lovely young woman who was ripped from their lives. Wanda had her whole life in front of her. She was robbed of ever becoming a mother. She was robbed of growing old with the love of her life. And she was even robbed of her identity when her killer became a media darling. It's difficult to find photos of Wanda McCoy online, but you can find several of her murderer. So say her name as much as you can. Her name is Wanda Faye McCoy. Southern Fried True Crime is produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched and written by Hannah Newcomb, with additional writing by me. The audio is edited and mixed by Ches Gray of Gray Multimedia. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. And thank you to Deidre Ward for suggesting today's case. As some of you already know, Facebook shut down our lovely group. It happened overnight, without warning or explanation, and it happened to many groups. But we have already started a new one. Search for Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group. We will still be worshiping our patron saint, Dolly Parton, sharing recipes and, in general, being supportive and good to each other. I still intend for it to be a safe and fun corner of Facebook, so the rule still is, no shit asses allowed. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I do not accept case suggestions on social media private messages. But please feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.